it's moving, so. Okay, this today is Monday, April 8th. We're starting from the beginning of Megillas Rus with some introduction, and then we'll start into the text itself. Okay, as we all know, there are five Megillos, and the five Megillos are part of the Nun of Tanakh. They're part of, the Chaf of Tanakh, part of the, I already have a bad thing on the tape, are part of the Chaf Ksuvim of Tanakh. And the question we have from the very beginning that we like to think about is, who wrote Sefer Rus? When was it written? And is there anything that we want to talk about in terms of the background of Rus before we look at it? And I think there's some very interesting pieces to it. So we'll spend a few minutes today by way of Akdoma, by way of introduction, as to where Sefer Rus comes from. First of all, Rus is, of course, part of Tanakh. It was included as part of Tanakh. And the Gemara in Bava Basra discusses what order the various Sfarim that appear in Tanakh, why they appear in the order that they appear. When there was what's called, I think in English, the canonization, the decision to include certain things into Tanakh, why after the Torah did this come before that or that come before this? There's a certain historical level that Shoftim would come right afterward, makes sense. But once you get into the where we are now in the Ksuvim, we're not necessarily going in any particular historical order. So we'll first look at an interesting Gemara from Bava Basra. Shana Rabbi Hosein, Sidran Shel Ksuvim, the order of Ksuvim, again, the Chof of Tanakh, overlooking my earlier mistake, should be Rus, Tehillim, Eov, Mishle, Koheles, Shir Hashirim, Kinos. That's interesting, they called it there Kinos. We have called that, we of course now call that Megillah Echa. Daniel, Megillas Esther, not Esther, Ezra, and Divrei Hayomim. So that was what was originally set, according to the Gemara, as the order. We know now that the order isn't like that. I made my little notes here. It's now Tehillim, Mishle, Eov, Shir Hashirim, and then the order we read it. So it's in a different order. So the Gemara there discusses, why did they change that order? Why is it different? Eov, I'm continuing that same Gemara, Eov bimei Moshe Hoya, Nikad Nibereisha. So if Moshe Rabbeinu wrote Eov according to the Masar, let's put that first, after all. It's Moshe Rabbeinu. So let's make that at the beginning. Problem is, it says, Yischalui pornusa la maschilinan. We don't start with misfortune. Rus, the Sefer Rus, starts with misfortune. In fact, it starts with misfortune on two levels, two aspects of misfortune, Poronius, which we'll see momentarily. So he says, Vaha Rus Poronusahi. So Rus can't be first. Now, is Eov not misfortune? If anyone ever learned Eov, you walk away from Eov not feeling too good. He is as sad and has a lot of sorrowful aspects to it, a lot of questions. There's some levels of despair. It's not easy to walk away from Eov and say there's no misfortune there. So how do we come to that? He says we should put it first. But no, he says there's Purnusa Yisrael. There's Purnusa there too. Damar Rabbi Yochanan and Lama Nikra Shema Rus. But Rus on the other hand, she's called Rus. Shezachsav Yasim and David. Shereiva LeKadosh Baruch Hu Shirus Yishbachis. It's called Rus. It has a good ending to it because David HaMelech comes from it. From Rus, which is described at the end of the Megillah itself, and therefore we can't consider it total Purunius, but it's still we have to give Eov credit over Moshe because Moshe Rabbeinu wrote it, so we have this order. So we have the order that we know it today. It's one of the five Megillahs. Of course, it's a Megillah that's read on the holiday of Shavuos, which is part of the reason why we're learning it now in the period of time between Pesach and Shavuos. And Rus has within it certain halachic issues that we don't see elsewhere and that are very unique to Rus, are very important to Rus, and we'll touch on them as we get to them. But just by way of introduction, there are questions raised in Rus. First of all, the question of what was the Jewish religious status of these two women, Rus and Arpah? Were they Jewish? They certainly weren't born Jewish, right? There it says that the Megillah says specifically, Nashim Moavios, they're Moabitess, is the English word for that, I think. They're Moabitess women. You're allowed to marry them? The Torah says about Moavi not coming into the Kal Hashem. How were they able to marry Moabitess women? So that's one question. Second, if you somehow darshened out that you're allowed to marry Moabitess women, else Moavi v'lo Moavis, the prohibition applies to a male Moabite and not to a Moabitess. Were they converted? And if so, who converted them? I saw something this morning that was quite interesting. What Jews do we know at the time were in Moab, at the time that they married Mahlon and Chilion? Who was there that we know for sure? Well, Naomi, she's not doing any conversions. Mahlon and Chilion, those are their soon-to-be husbands. If we have a big tumult in our days that rabbis should not be converting people so they can get married, we certainly don't want the husbands doing the conversions so they can get married. And anyway, who are they? They're not Bezdin. So it's a real question. What happened to them? Did they convert? Who converted them? How did they convert? What's that all about? So the halachic issue of Moavi v'lo Moavis and their status, was Geirus required in those days? We see that there certainly is a remez, which we'll get to it on another day, a remez to the fact that there was a conversion, because in the whole dialogue between Rus and Naomi, stay, go, no, you go back, no, I want to stay, you want to go, no, you want to stay, she says at one point, your God is my God. Your God is my God. Is that an acknowledgement of the acceptance that there was some kind of conversion? Certainly some reference to that, right? So that's one question. And then the other halachic issue which comes through is, this is the first time we have this extension of Yibum, this levirate marriage. Rus ultimately marries Boaz through a levirate marriage, through Yibum, because he's the Goel, he is the Redeemer. But we know there was one closer, Goel Karvimeni, who he says, and his name, Karvimeni, his name was Ploni Almoni, it wasn't his name, but they referred to him as Ploni Almoni, the then equivalent of what we would say John Doe or something like that. How did that work? How does Yibum work in this case? A lot of issues about Yibum. Does she really fall to Yibum? Is she Jewish? If she's not Jewish, does she fall to Yibum? Who's Boaz? How does Boaz come into this? So there's questions, halachic questions, which we'll see. So let's go back a little bit to the introduction of this Sefer Rus. Who wrote it? Shmuel HaNavi, right? Shmuel HaNavi wrote it. We know that we have a Masorah. It's a continuation of that same Gemara in Bava Basra was referred to before. Umi Kosvan. Remember, we left off talking about Eov and Rus. Moshe Kosov, Sif Moshe Rabbeinu wrote Eov. Shmuel Kosov, Shmuel HaNavi, Shmuel Ramosi, wrote three things that we traditionally ascribe to him. One, Sifro. What's Sifro? Well, Shmuel, his own Sefer. Two, Sefer Shoftim. And three, Rus. So Shmuel HaNavi wrote it. And the connection to Shoftim is clear from the very first Pasuk. When, though, did he write it? And when did these events, which are the essence of this Sefer, occur? Now, those two dates are not the same, right? They're obviously not the same. I could today, we're talking about Lahavdils, right? I could today, if I knew anything about it, write the history of the Civil War. I know nothing about it. But I could write the history of the Civil War. And the fact that I'm writing it today doesn't change the fact that the events which gave rise to the Civil War happened, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, I think 1860 to 1865 or 1861. 61. 61, okay, see, I would be a bad historian, but that doesn't change that. The fact that I write it in 2013, the events happened then. So there's two separate questions for us. When did the events happen that gave rise to this story? And second, when was it written down? Two different questions. Okay, so what do we know about that? The Megillah itself doesn't tell us specifically. It tells us instead, Vayihi b'yimei shvot hashoftim, at the time when the judges judged. Now, what is the tekufa of the shoftim? It starts with Yoshua's time and goes until Shaul HaMelech. Until Shaul HaMelech becomes the king, that is the period of the shoftim. How many years is that? If anybody's up on their years, I had to look it up, so. It's 350 years. Now, all these years are plus minus, but it's 350 years. Okay, so it happened, we've narrowed it down, it happened during this 350-year period. When, though, in the 350-year period did it happen? We don't know. We do, though, have some clues. As with everything else in the dating of these things, there's different viewpoints, different mandomers as to when it happened. But we do have some clues. Let's take some of them. We know that there's a Gemara in Bava Basra that says, who's our protagonist in the good part of the story, the male protagonist? Boaz. It says that Boaz is Ivtson. Ivtson was the name of one of the Shoftim. So if indeed Boaz, as the Masechta tells us, Boaz is Ivtson, we kind of know when that was. We kind of have a sense of when that was. But we have another clue. We have another clue from the Megillah itself as to when it happened. And oddly enough, the clue comes exactly where we expect it not to come, from the last two psukim. The clue is to the beginning, is at the very, very, very end. What does it say at the end? The last couple psukim. And we're talking about, remember, the last two psukim, which some would tell you is the ikar of this entire Megillah, because it's the genealogy which ends up with David HaMelech. It says like this, that there was a person, he goes through the names, Salmon Holidas Boaz. Okay, Salmon Holidas Boaz, and Boaz Holidas Oved. Okay, so now that Boaz is the father of Oved, Oved Holidas Yishai, making Boaz the grandfather of Yishai, the Yishai Holidas David, and Yishai is the father of David, making, if I'm not mistaken, Boaz the great-grandfather of David, right? Now, that doesn't tell us when it's written, but it tells us that the Boaz story, if he's the great-grandfather, the span of time from Boaz meeting, marrying Rus and David being born is going to be what? We're not talking about Mesushelach with 900-year lives. We're talking about people who live the kind of lives that we think about and hear about. So what are we talking about altogether? About 100 years. Now, if you go back and figure out when Ivtson was a shofet, that takes us right into that period, kind of the last 100 years of the Tkufas HaShoftim. So it kind of lines up, and it lines up with one other thing. Obviously, this had to be written after David HaMelech had ascended to some importance. They would not go through a Megillah and then give us four psukim at the end to tell us the genealogy of the guy who cuts the grass. I mean, it would have to be somebody who matters. So we know that the genealogy, the lineage of David, would have mattered. So it's at some point when he's already either is king or it's subsequent to his being king, but at some point when he had an important position. We know that from the time that Tkufa the Shoftim ended, Shaul was the first king. And how long did Shaul reign? 2 years. Only 2 years. Very short period of time. And then David. So it all kind of works. It all kinds of works. So it's 100-ish, plus or minus. These events happened 100 or so years after the 100 years, the last 100 or so years of Shoftim.
Of the 350.
Of the 350, right, exactly. Now, when was it written? That's a little bit of a harder question to answer. One of the thoughts is that it was, you know, written at the time, right at when David became king, and Shmuel wanted to explain how important David was and who his roots were. He was his personal historian or personal biographer. We don't know. Another thought is that it was written at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, what is the theme, one of the themes that we talked about that goes through this Megillah, which would be consistent with Ezra and Nehemiah writing it? Coming back from Golos to Eretz Yisrael. And when these fellows were coming back from Golos to Eretz Yisrael, who were they bringing with them? Yeah, I mean, in terms of their families, who were they bringing with them? They were also bringing these wives, what exactly was the status of these women? So Ezra and Nehemiah were involved in railing against that issue. So it would be consistent with what was going on, that they would talk about, that would be written in their time, the Shiva Tzion, that you don't just take these women, they have to convert, they have to this, they have to that. So that would be consistent with that as well. We don't know exactly. What we do know, the Masechta, is it was written by Shmuel HaNavi. It seems by all the cheshbonos that we talked about that it was written toward the last 100 years or so, that happened in the last 100 years or so of the Shoftim's Tkufa. When it was ultimately written down, we're never really going to, we don't know exactly. And we know from the Gemara that it was included in Tanakh, and it was ultimately included in the position that it's in now, not in the second position. That's a little bit of background on Rus. We read Rus on the holiday of Shavuos. I heard last year that they pulled out a certain number of eighth grade students from proper schools, and said, you have 2 minutes. Tell me the five Megillos and what days they are read. And most of them couldn't get it. Everybody knows Esther is written on Purim, is read on Purim. And everyone knows Eicha is read on Tisha B'Av, and this is read on Shavuos. When you start cheshbening, Koheles, is it Shabbos Chol-Moed, is it Shmini Atzeret, and Shir Shirim, is it Shabbos Chol-Moed Pesach? They didn't do it. But we know Rus is read on the holiday of Shavuos. There, the connection is the David connection, but as well, it's the Chag, it's the harvest connections, because we are celebrating at the time of Shavuos these harvests. Yes?
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
We talked about the Shavuot, and I've had this question for a while, and Pirkei Avos, you say Moshe passed it on to Shavuot, to the Zakenim. Is it Zakenim?
That's the time when we're getting into the Shoftim.
So, in other words, you could change it.
Well, you know also that at the time when, I mean, how far back these names go, because there was times when Paro was taking Eitzos from different people, and when those people lived, and where was Boaz, and Boaz was in the Bezdin, and Boaz was in the Cain. These people appear at different times. Okay, Vayehi bimei Shvot HaShoftim. And it came to pass, or and it was, at the time when the judges judged. We all have heard this Gemara before. There's a Gemara in Megillah that says any time when we have Vayehi, we're in for trouble. And Vayehi, Bimei, we're in for trouble. And some say that Vayehi comes from like, oi, oi, here we go, voy, voy, woe. I guess that's probably the English word from woe comes from that.
It's sounds like, word.
What?
It's an international
word. Yeah, woe.
In the German language, English, whatever you use. Oi, Latin is Y-W-V-A-A-E, and woe in English seems to be an international word.
So that's what we have. So we have Vayib Mei Shvayta Shoftim. And a bad thing we're about to hear about at the time of the Shvayta Shoftim. There were five Vayib Meis that we have. Rafael is one of them. We have different places. This one I'm reading to you now from Yalkut Shimoni. He says, Vayihi bimei Shvot HaShoftim. Now, before we say that, normally speaking, what does Shvot HaShoftim mean? When the judge is judged. Kind of a normal expression during the time of the tukufa of the judges. However, when you have this Vayihi bimei Shvot HaShoftim, something is wrong. Something is wrong. Why don't you just say Vayihi bimei Shoftim? Something's wrong with this tkufa of the Shoftim. So Yalkut Shimoni brings this midrash. Vayihi bimei Shvot HaShoftim. This is continuing after he started by saying Vayihi bimei means we're about to hear Tzaras Chavra. Matzara Haisasham. What was the Tzara that was then? You go a few words down, it says Vayihi Rav Baaretz. But it's worse than that. Moshal Medina Shaisa Chayeves Liyapis HaMelech. What about a country who had to give tribute, tax to the king? Sholach HaMelech Gabai Tomyan LeGavaisa. They sent someone out to collect the taxes. Ma'osu B'nei HaMedina. What did the equivalent of the Boston Tea Party do at that time? Hikuoso Ganuoso Omru Oilanu Shargis HaMelech B'dvarim HaLalu. Ma'ashe B'kesh Lasos Lanu Asinu Lo. We're going to do to him what he's trying to do. He's trying to hurt us by taking taxes. We're going to hurt him. Now, how does that come to our question about the judges? Kach bimei Shvot HaShoftim. Hoya echad b'Yisrael. For example, a Jewish fellow, Oved Avodas Alilim. He was guilty of what we would call idol worship. Hadayan, the judge, Shofet Dayan, him, Mivakes Lavor Alav Es Adin. Wanted to give him, you know, has din. Ha Yehu ba, umalkin sadayin. He would come and hit the giant. He would hit the judge. Judge wants to punish him. He punishes the judge. He hits the judge. Omar, mashi b'keish la'asos li, asisi lo. I'll fix him. What he was going to do to me, I'll do back to him. Safku kulam, oi, voy, oi lador, shishaftu es shoftehim. Woe is it to the generation whose judges behave in this way. And we have so many examples.
So is the judge behaving in a way, or is it the people they're judging?
The judges. In other words, the judge, we go on. We go on to see that the judge who wanted to punish him for doing Avodah Zarah was doing Avodah Zarah himself. The judge who said, don't take, have mercy on widows and orphans and so on, himself was oppressing widows and orphans. So this was a group that was not to be believed. In all the various ways in the corruption and all the terrible things that happened. There's a pasuk in Shoftim, which says specifically that obviously at this time, by Yomim Ahim, this is Shoftim Yud, by Yomim Ahim, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, obviously it's Shoftim time, so there is no king, Ein Melech B'Yisrael, so what happens? Ish HaYosher B'Ein Avyaseh, everybody does what he wants. V'gam, Lo HaYosh Shofet Echad, Miyuchad L'Kol Yisrael, nor was there a Shofet that everybody agreed upon. It's like Hech Sherim today. Nobody could accept anybody else's. Everybody was fighting. So we end up in as you mentioned, Pirkei Avos. What's it say in Pirkei Avos? That if there's no more of the Malchus, Ish Yisrael v'chayim b'loya. If you don't have any respect for the authorities, for the governing body, everybody swallows everybody else. And that's it. So this was a terrible time. This was Vayihi b'mei Shvot HaShoftim. That the Shoftim themselves were in this terrible situation. And that's why, this is the Siba, this is the reason why these things happened to the people. What was the bad thing that happened? There's a second bad thing in this pasuk. What is it? Vayihi rov baretz. As a result of their neglect of the system of law, as a result of their failure to give respect to the judges, failure to respect Torah mitzvahs, what happened? Rov baloyim. There was famine. There was hunger. So vayihi beishod hashod vayihi rov baretz. That's what happened. Now what do we get? We get somebody who's an ish. Vayelech ish. What's an ish mean? Normally an ish means a man. But this guy was a real ish. He was a gvir. Rashi says, Asher gadol haya. Uparnes hador. He was the biggest gvir of the time. He supported everyone. He was the main person. V'shem ha'ish, his name was Elimelech. It's a beautiful name. It means my God is king. It's equivalent to the name also of Malkiel, Elimelech and Malkiel. These are important names, important person. V'shem Ishtai, what was the name of his wife? Naomi. Another beautiful name, a pleasant person, a sweet name. Naomi, right? And what does he name his kids? V'shem Shnei Bonav, Machlon V'chilyon. Pestilence, disease, destruction. Anybody here been to a bris lately where they named the kids pestilence and destruction? Two nice young fellas. What happens? And they were Ephrasim. What does Ephrasim mean? They were from Ephras. Where's Ephras? Who's buried in there? So what did it say? Rachel was buried, right? But Derek Beislach, he Ephras. Derek Ephras, he Beislach. On the way to Ephras, Beislach. And today, the modern place, Ephras, Ephrat, is, I don't know the distances too much, but I know it's in the area of Beit Lechem. So, he says, Ephrasim, Rashi says, they were chashuvim. They were the important people. They were the wealthy people. They were the leaders. They were the leaders. So, if they were the leaders, and they were the wealthy people, by the way, he says, Beis Lechem Yehuda. Why does he have to tell us Ephras is in Beis Lechem, but Beis Lechem is in Yehuda? Why does he have to tell us that? We know. We know all the places. Why does he have to tell us that? In fact, there is another Beis Lechem. It's in Zvulun. I'm not so good on geography, but it's in the Shevet Zvulun's territory. So there is another one. So what's it tell us? Don't make a mistake. It's Beis Lechem Yehuda, the one, the nice one, the good one, where all the places were. Now, what does he do, this great person? During the time of famine, what does he do? Runs away. Vayavo Elimelech and his chavre and his family, they run away. Vayavos de Moav vayusham. They ran to Moav. Grass is greener. Why did he run away? Why did he run away? The Malbim says, Kasher hoya ish ashir, hoya yorei, shehaniyim yiplu olav yishlalu kol asheloi. He was afraid that the aniyim would take things from him. Some places it says later he ran away because of Tzaras Ayin. He had a bad feeling. He didn't want to help anybody. He wanted to get out of there because he was afraid that all the people would seek to get food from him. Before, he was a big deal. He had a lot of everything. Now, the poor are going to take food from me, I don't want to support them, I'm getting out of here. What makes that particularly bad? Why was he living in the area of Yehuda? Why is anyone living anywhere in those days? Because that's your ancestral home. That's the Shevet, that you're the descendant. That was the land that was given to you. So the people in his area who would be seeking him out for help were who? Yehuda means his what? His mishpacha, his kinsmen. He's turning his back on his own family. These are not just strangers showing up. This is his fellow Yehudites, if there's such a word. These are his people. And he turns his back on them. Tzar Zion, he says, I'm not looking at them the way they were. Rashi says, Vayelech ish asher gado haya. V'yotza mi'eretz Yisrael l'chutz l'aretz mipnei tzaras ha'ayin. Shehayisa eno tzara be'enov v'habayim l'docho l'kach nenash. He was afraid that they were going to come and push him for food and have to help them. U'l'kach nenash. And as a result of this bad attitude, he was punished. He was punished. All these people in this group are from who, ultimately? If we take it back far enough, Elimelech and his sons, Omar, Rav, Chonan, Bar, Rabba, Omar, Rav, Elimelech, Salmon, Ploni, Almoni, Vavi, Naomi, Kulam, all of them descend back to who? Nachshon ben Aminadav. Nachshon ben Aminadav, that's a yichus. That's a yichus. You're going to go for a shidduch today, and you say you can take your yichus back to Nachshon ben Aminadav, you get the choice girls. What does this teach us? Mai kamashmalon, afilu mishi yeshlo zchus avos, ena omedes lo b'sha sheyotzei me'aretz lechutz laretz. You leave Eretz Yisrael. You're in Eretz Yisrael. Of course, we're all sitting here, so it gets a little warm when we talk about this subject. But these people who had this great yichus and these great zchusim, they lost the zchus avos when they decided to leave Eretz Yisrael, especially to leave under such circumstances. And the Medrash goes on to say that there are maybe exceptions when food was so scarce and so rare, and it says that the price was less than such. Others say, no, even if it's scarce and rare, you have to say. But he left, and he was punished. Nenshu sheyatsu ma'aretz lechutz la'aretz. That this was one of the reasons why they had punishment. Another says, b'pnei ma nenshu, shehayolem levakish rachmi ma'adoram. What happens? They were the leaders. What should they have done? They should have been out there praying. Mevakish rachamim. Pray to God for mercy that the famine, whatever it was at the time, the famine should end. I don't know if it was because of rain or what, but they should have been praying for the people. Instead, what did they do? Snuck out. And they snuck out in a way that it kind of gives you the impression that they kind of walked out in the middle of the night. How do we know that? Anyway, that says, Vayelech Eishmi Beis Lechem Yehuda. He didn't say, Vayisa, we don't have chariots and all. He kind of walked out, walked away. And there's an interesting diuk in the language in that second half of that first pasuk. It says, Vayelech Ish mi Beis Lechem Yehuda, Logor B'Stei Moav, a guy from Beis Lechem Yehuda left, not a guy, an Ish, to live in Stei Moav, comma, he and his wife and kids. That's not normal. You would normally say, Vayelech ish veishto ushnei banav vayelchu agur be'eretz Moav. Why? Because it wants to show that this was his decision. This ish, this great ish, he decided, not Naomi, not the boys, he decided that he was leaving. And they went with him, but the decision was his. Okay. Vayomas Elimelech ish Naomi. It says Elimelech, the wife, the husband of Naomi, died. Why, we're asked, Rashi asks, why does it have to say Ish Naomi? We're only three psukim into this. We have decent memories. There's not much chance that in the last 30 seconds we forgot who he was married to. So why does it tell us, Vayomas Elimelech Ish Naomi? Rashi tells us an interesting thing about the relationship between husband and wife. Rashi says, Lama Nemar Mekan Amru Ein Ish Meis. When a person dies, the true death, the true loss, is felt by the wife. Other people hear, oh, such and such died, what a tragedy, and they go home, close the door, they're back to their families. She's the one, when she closes the door, is now alone. She's the one who's now preparing for one person instead of two. She's the one on a day-to-day basis, as we would say in the Lashon of Medina, 24/7, feels the loss of the husband. So it says, Ishnami, to make it clear how she felt and how she suffered the loss of her husband.
Then why does she only mourn 30 days, whereas the child mourns for an entire year?
The reason that the mourning... The reason for a sibling and a spouse... A sibling is the same. You could ask the same question of a sibling. The sibling and the spouse 30 days is because spouses and siblings are replaceable. In other words, I know it doesn't sound nice, but you could remarry. You may have other siblings, but when a parent dies, you have but one father. You have but one mother. So that kufa of mourning is a longer lasting one. Yes, she's the one who feels his death most, but the truth is she ultimately can remarry. Person loses their father, you know, their mother remarries them, but they're not getting another father, they're getting a stepfather. So, well, that's a good question. Vayamas Elimelech Ishnami Vatishaer he Ushne Vaneha. And she is left alone. Tishaer, she remains. It's just her. She's on her own and her two sons. Vatishaer he, she's alone, and she has two sons. They're not yet married. Ostensibly, they're not much, you know, they're not of the age of majority. So she is left alone here in Moab. She's left here in Moab. Okay, so according to the Cheshbon of Rabbi Greenspan, told me I'm at end of my time. So we'll pick up tomorrow. I want you to think about this one question. If Naomi is one of the heroines here, right, she's one of the great ones here in this story, how come right here, right now, husband dies, she doesn't say, boys, we're going home. We'll leave it with them until tomorrow.